This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
I'm Ben Gideon.
Ben, how are you doing over there on the East Coast? I've just got to say one thing I got to do over the past week was go to the season opener Buffalo Bills Rams game with my family, and I could not have been happier with the start of the NFL season and everything that's happening.
Yeah, there were some that were thinking the Bills were going to go backwards this year, but I don't see that happening. You know, after the game one opener for the Patriots, I think I'm going to take a break from football for a while. I've decided. I actually, my son and I went to the U.S. Open, and I become fixated on tennis. I think I averaged between 2 and 4 hours of tennis watching a day during the U.S. Open, and I've also become obsessed with listening to this podcast called the Tennis Podcast, which are these three Brits who talk about tennis. It's amazing how soothing that is to hear British people just talk about tennis. It's just such a nice break from the rest of the world. So I might be going in that direction. So I haven't seen you since your Belize trip. How did that go?
Oh, it was fantastic. It was our 20-year wedding anniversary. And for anybody who hasn't been to Belize, I highly recommend it. It's a beautiful place. It's got amazing rainforests. If you're an adventurer, there's caving and tubing and all sorts of spelunking down there. Great hiking, and then you go to the islands and the water's beautiful. It's the largest active barrier reef in the world. So there's just so much to see and do. And it's super reasonable also. So it's a place that I think would welcome everybody on almost any budget.
Well, that sounds awesome. So we're really excited today to welcome Brent Walker to the podcast. Brent is a partner in the law firm of Aldous and Walker out of Dallas, Texas, and exceptional trial lawyer. We'll talk about the huge verdicts and great cases, both the PI type cases and also what he likes to call the cause cases, where he's getting involved in championing really important causes in Texas. But before that, welcome, Brent. We're excited to have you on the show.
Thank you, Ben, and thank you, Raul. Really excited to be here virtually with y'all. I always enjoy my time with y'all in person more, but it's good to be here virtually. And Ben, I'm glad you clarified that it was the tennis version of the U.S. Open, because when you said U.S. Open, I thought, is that the golf one? Is that going on? So appreciate that clarification.
I haven't sunk low enough to spend time following golf yet, but I'm sure that's coming next.
Yeah.
Hey, happy birthday, by the way, Brent.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, it was on Monday. It was quite an enjoyable birthday. Had the usual Monday morning headache questions that people think up over the weekend just to drive me crazy. So that was a nice birthday gift.
What are you, like 24 now?
25. My hairline says I'm 50.
Wow, you're catching up to me. So, Brent, can you take us back? I know that you decided or thought from an early age that you might go into the law because your mom was actually a lawyer, right? Tell us about what that was like and growing up with a mother who was a trial lawyer.
Yeah, so it was a very fascinating thing to have. I imagine all of our kids will have this experience in their life as well, because there's so many interesting things that we do as lawyers, people we can help. And our kids, they get to see that. And they get to learn that we make impacts on people's lives. And so as a child growing up, I can distinctly remember my mother trying a case involving a police officer that was shot and killed. It was called Ronnie Cox versus the City of Dallas, and it was a big case here in Dallas. And I remember when I watched her do that case and the impact she had on that family, I knew at that age that that's what I wanted to do. And so I never really wavered from the time I was about 13 years old to the time I got here that this is what I wanted to do with my life.
It's interesting that, I mean, probably in that era, it was less common for a woman to be such a successful out front trial lawyer. It's more common today, although sadly not even common enough today, right? But was that something you appreciated when you were a kid, how what a kind of groundbreaker your mom was?
No, I did not appreciate how odd it was in the 80s to have lawyers who are female out on big, important cases. It just never occurred to me that was a thing, because that was my mom, and I was proud of my mom, and figured that was just something that moms can do. And it wasn't until I started working with my partner, Charla, and heard about the things that she had to deal with as a young lawyer. First time I really appreciated how difficult it has been for some of these wonderful, remarkable female attorneys to really make a name for themselves and fight through all the garbage they had to deal with.
So take us from that growing up with your mom as a trial lawyer to how you got into the business yourself.
Well, I always knew I wanted to go to law school, and I came to Dallas, where I was born and raised, and went to SMU. And I had the pleasure of working with a legendary trial lawyer here in Texas, a gentleman named Frank Branson. And so throughout law school, I spent all my time up there at Frank's office, watching them and learning from them. I didn't exactly have great attendance at law school because my law school was actually working in the firm. But after that, I wanted to go get some real good hands-on experience, and I went and did defense work for a while. And I think, Ben, you might have done some corporate work yourself, and it's good experience, but it just doesn't feed your soul. And I distinctly remember there was a case that I had where I'd gone down to the courthouse and had a summary judgment granted. And I know when I walked in the door of that hearing that the judge was going to deny the summary judgment and he was going to let this young boy have his day in court. But for some reason, I made an argument that I thought was clever and changed the judge's mind, and he threw this case out. And this young 18-year-old boy never got his day in court. And I remember getting in the car, driving home, calling my wife and saying, I can't do this anymore. I can't live with myself. So it was fortunate that right when I was leaving that position, my partner Charla was looking for someone to partner up with. And so we got connected, and that was more than a decade ago. And over the last decade, I've had just the most wonderful, fascinating career that is everything I ever wanted it to be, even when I was that little kid.
Did you know going in when you decided to partner with Charla, had she already reached legendary status at that stage in her career, or was she still on her way toward that?
Charla was already extraordinarily well known as being a phenomenal trial lawyer. I think that legend has even grown over the last decade or so. But when I first got the option to visit with Charla, I was floored. She had just obtained some $363 million verdict. Everyone in Dallas was abuzz about it. I told my wife I was going to go work with this female solo practitioner. And I think my wife's first glance was like, I don't know about this. But I was like, I don't think you understand my sweet wife. This is probably the greatest trial lawyer in our state. I've now learned that I think she's the greatest jury lawyer in the country. So I was very fortunate to have had that opportunity strike when it did.
So what have you gained, knowledge base or sort of tools in your toolbox from Charla? Getting to spend 10 years with her is something any trial lawyer would like to do and learn from.
Sure. I think probably the one thing that really has been the most beneficial to me is the fact that the way that she approaches cases, we really focus on our clients as far as connecting with them, developing a relationship with them. That's something that I wanted, something I didn't like in my other job. And Charla and I, after every time we meet with new clients, we just ask ourselves, can we help these people? These are the people we can't not help. You know, is this someone that we have to help because we really believe in what they're telling us? And so that has always been something that Charla and I have connected with that has really come, I think, to define our practice is how we choose cases. As far as skills go, I go to a lot of CLEs and I talk to other lawyers all the time, and they always ask me about how does Charla do it? How does Charla connect with the jury the way that she connects with them? And the answer is I could probably tell you. I've learned it over the years. I know what she's going to say before she says it. But there's not anything you can take away from it. The only thing you can take away from it is you have to be yourself, because you can't be Charla all this. Charla connects with juries, in my view, because of how she basically climbs in the box with them. She lays herself bare. She exposes her vulnerabilities. She really lets the jury know how she feels about every single thing that's happening. Every comment from a witness, every piece of evidence, the jury knows how she feels about it, because that's who Charla is. She's a very empathetic, very extraordinarily high emotional intelligence. And so that's just the type of person she is. And when she's authentically herself, that connects with jurors. And so anyone who wants to know what she's doing with the hopes of copying her, I have always tell them that that's a fool's errand. I tried early on trying to do some of the things that she does, and it doesn't work for me. But I think we have complementary skills that she's helped foster in me, and I think it's turned out really well for us. But there's no copy in Charla. She's the one and only.
That point you made about complementary skills, I don't know who I was talking to recently, but they were telling me there's data on male-female trial teams and that juries tend to like that. And there's data that shows that there are better results from that combination than single lawyers or lawyers, same gender lawyers trying cases together. But what's the dynamic like when you guys do the trial together? Do you play different roles? How do you play off each other and complement each other with your respective strengths and weaknesses?
So I haven't seen that data. I have anecdotal data, and I think it works out really well for us. And I think it works out well for us because we are both be who we are. And the way that I approach things is very different than the way she approaches things. We both, I think the jury both knows that we're extraordinarily passionate and believe fully in what our case is about. And but the presentation and the way that we present ourselves is just different, but in a complementary way. And when you have 12 jurors sitting in the box, there are some people who I think will read the evidence a different way. They'll respond differently to our different approaches. And so I think we kind of have the ability to sort of cover the waterfront as far as connecting with jurors. When we talk to jurors after some of our verdicts, they seem to like the different dynamics. Actually work through the trial because of our different skill sets. I think it really helps us in how we build our case. Usually the last couple of trials, what we do is Charla will do voir dire and she connects with people immediately. They love her from the outset. I'll usually do opening statement. I'm a little more methodical in how I approach things. Sort of build the case in opening statement. We'll then split up the witnesses. Sometimes it just depends on what the personality of the witness is. We'll decide which one of us will do better. We have different abilities as far as driving defense lawyers or defense witnesses crazy. It just depends on what the personality of that witness is. And then on our own clients and our own witnesses, we decide, you know, hey, if you have a grieving mother here, is that going to be better to have her take that witness or myself? And we just kind of are very flexible about that. Sometimes having a guy like me beat up on a female witness might offend some of the jurors. And so we'll have Charla handle that one. Sometimes there might be a male witness who we know is going to be hyper-aggressive, and we may want to have me do it for certain reasons, or may have Charla want to do it for certain reasons if we want to play off the fact that this man is trying to walk all over this female lawyer, which won't happen, but it'll look really bad when he tries. So we make all these decisions based on that. And then usually in closing, I'll close up and then Charla will do the rebuttal and kind of really drive home the emotional aspect of it. So it's an interesting dynamic, but I think it's one that's very effective. I've had the pleasure of working on a case with Mark Lanier years ago, and Mark is a phenomenal trial lawyer, and he is known for the fact he does everything himself. He's the only counsel at the counsel table, and that works for him. I don't think him having another trial partner is going to improve anything for him, but it works for him because that's who he is. It doesn't work for everybody. I think for most people, there's probably value in having more than one trial counsel there and dividing them up and having different personalities and different skill sets.
So I had kind of a slight change in topic, but you've got like a sort of a soft confidence that is an undertone with how you present yourself, which is super awesome. My question is, do you ever get nervous leading up into a trial? And, or is there certain moments that you normally get nervous and then it all kind of goes away and you're ready to roll?
Yeah, I think I'm definitely in the latter book. I don't know what it is about trial. I feel most at home in trial. I don't get nervous talking to jurors. I get nervous talking to you guys. I get nervous in social settings. I have social anxiety. In big groups, I don't like being the loud voice. But when I'm in a trial and I'm talking to the jurors, I feel like I can be myself, and I feel like I can just, they're going to listen to me and they're going to accept what I'm telling them or not, but they're going to listen. And it's really the one place I think I feel the most at home. I really miss trials. The thing about COVID has been the worst is not having trials, because that to me is the real thing that is the joy of our practice.
Brent, can you just talk a little bit about your law firm? I'm interested because almost 2 years ago now, I started a firm, and it's a small firm. Now we have three lawyers and four staff, and we're actually hiring if anybody's interested. But you guys have a model where you're very selective about the cases you take, obviously, and you divide it up between your kind of revenue producing cases, a high value personal injury and medical malpractice cases, and the kind of pro bono work you do, which we'll get into in a moment. And to do that, you have to be very selective. And obviously, you have to say, probably have to say no a lot more than you say yes to people, right?
Yes, absolutely. It's rather a frustration for me on a daily basis where we have to tell people no. Texas has some really bad laws, especially in medical malpractice, and we're known as one of the top medical malpractice firms, but there's only a very narrow segment of cases that we can really undertake, and as far as medical malpractice goes. And so we reject several medical malpractice cases a day. It's a very frustrating thing. I wish that was not the case. I really wish we could undertake more, but we have built our practice in a way that we maintain a small docket. We have four lawyers, Charla, myself, and two wonderful associates. We try to keep our docket to 20 cases or less, with the notion that we'll all be working on them. We'll all know what's going on in all of them. When we go to trial, the whole team will go to trial. So in order to do that, we have to maintain a small docket. And if it's going to be a small docket, we have to be very selective in the cases, because the cases we do have to keep the lights on for us so that we can pursue some of the other cause cases we want. So yeah, selectivity is something that we've had to do, but it's something that we're also fortunate to do. We really get to choose who we want to represent. We don't take cases just because we think they're going to make money or just because we have a opening. We take cases only when we meet with our clients and we think this is someone we have to represent.
Do you have an example of a couple of cases that you're working on, your cause cases?
So our firm over the last couple of years have really decided to take on some of the challenging things that are occurring in our state of Texas. We have decided to help our county commissioner here in Dallas County in a fight against the governor involving some of the mass litigation. You know, I grew up in Texas, and when I was in Texas high school learning about Texas law, there was always this pride about the fact that Texas was its own country for a little while, and that Texas didn't want to have all the oppression from the leader of Mexico and didn't want to have the oppression of the United States. And we wanted to have a very weak central government. And so that was sort of the legend of Texas. And when we established our constitution, we made a very weak governor. I don't remember if you recall when George W. Bush was running for president, everyone said, hey, that's Texas. That's a weak governorship. So there's nothing special about him being governor. Well, over the last 3 or 4 years in Texas, our governor has really been aggressive in sort of trying to accumulate power. And he has done so, I believe, in contravention of what the Texas Constitution provides. So we have all of our cases, keep the lights on, and we have some of these other cases. So one of them is this case where we are pursuing the governor of the state of Texas and a sort of battle between the local officials and the state officials about who can make decisions about what type of public health measures are required by the COVID crisis. That's actually before the Supreme Court of Texas right now. And we're looking forward to see how that goes. We then also filed a lawsuit against the governor and the attorney general involving some decisions he made recently about trying to make transgender care by doctors, making that a crime, calling it child abuse and making it something that can be punishable in the criminal courts. And we represent a doctor who provides that care, and we've been taking on the efforts of the governor and the attorney general to impose this notion that it's child abuse to care for these children. So we've been handling that matter as well. So we have sort of these public interest type things, but we have also cause cases that, at least what we call cause cases, that are just normal civil cases, but they're cases that when we undertake them, we believe there's not really much anything that we can accomplish. So for about 2 years, I worked on a case on behalf of 9 men who were sexually abused in the early 80s by some Jesuit priests. The notion was, as we were going to kind of take on the Texas statute of limitations law, I think the statute of limitations for these cases in Texas ran at some point when Ollie North was testifying on Iran-Contra in the 80s. So it was well past the statute when we brought the case. And we met with this client, his wonderful guy named Mike Pettavilla. And we had no intention of taking on the Catholic Church or taking on a sexual abuse case at that time. But we sat down and met with this guy. And just hearing his story afterwards, we said, we have to represent him. There's no case here because of the statute. We'll see what we can figure out. But we got to represent him. And so we took that case on and ended up representing 9 other men who were abused.
Can you just tell us in a nutshell, what the story is?
So there's a school in Dallas called Jesuit High School, and it's a wonderful high school. It's a well-regarded high school. I think my son wants to go to Jesuit. It's a great place, but in the 80s, and actually in the 70s and 80s, it was not such a great place. The school was run by the Jesuits, and they had Jesuit priests who were engaged in sexual abuse of minors who were put into that school. They were moved around from school to school if these priests did anything wrong. And for some reason, a lot of them ended up at the school in Dallas, and they were abusing a lot of kids. And anytime it was reported to the Jesuits themselves. And that was sort of kept under wraps for decades. And then about 3 years ago, the Diocese of Dallas, along with a lot of the dioceses, I think all dioceses in the United States, issued a list of priests against whom there have been credible accusations of child abuse. And when that list came out, our client, Mike Pettavilla, noticed that somebody who should have been on that list wasn't there. And that was a guy named Pat Koch, who had abused Mike. And Mike came forward, visited with us, and he told us his story about how after, when he was 15 years old, after he was abused, his once promising academic career fell apart. He got involved in drugs and alcohol and suicidal issues and depression, and his whole life was ruined. And he had been struggling for a very, very long time. And so he originally came to us with the frustration that this priest was not on a list that he should be on, because Mike knows that the priest abused him. And so he wanted us to raise this issue and try to make sure this priest was acknowledged as someone who abused others. The Dallas Morning News picked it up, reported on it, and next thing we know, we started getting calls from a lot of other men. And it was shocking that every time these men contacted us and told us their story, it was the same story. It was the same story about kids who had promising futures, never had any issues, Often they were the smallest kids in the class, or they came from a difficult family background, and these priests would abuse them, and then their lives would just tank. Drugs, alcohol, sexual issues. And they all said the same thing, that they thought they were the only one, that maybe they had done something that had caused them to be abused, or to be done something to lead the priest on, maybe, or they had done something else that caused them to be the right type of victim for this priest. But they always thought that they were the only one. And they'd been living with this doubt and fear and anguish and frustration. And so it was really remarkable how the cases all had the same story. It turned out there was four different priests that we actually pursued cases against. And the priests, each of those four priests had basically an MO, and how they abused these kids followed the same MO. And so we undertook these cases and challenged the statute of limitations. And it was a great credit to the school, the current Jesuit high school, that they said from the outset, they weren't going to use the statute of limitations as a defense, that they wanted to do right by these men. And the Jesuit order, though, the order of priests, they didn't take that position. They were going to fight it. They were going to use the statute of limitations. And so we fought with them pretty heavily for years, trying to get all the information public and get it out there, because we knew there was other men who were suffering in silence. And we thought, if we can get this information public, at least that will help these other men. But ultimately, there was a guy named Lee Taft, and maybe get into the weeds, but this is something that I think is absolutely fascinating. But it's something I think that we ought to be thinking about in our other cases. This gentleman named Lee Taft, who used to be a plaintiff's lawyer like us, he then went to divinity school because he didn't like the fact that the only thing that civil law delivers to us is money. I'm sure we have all had this conversation with our client. You know, the only thing we can do as lawyers is bring you money and hope to try to make change. But at the end of the day, if we go to trial, all it is money. And Lee didn't like that, because Lee thought that was not fully healing to people who were victimized. And so he went to divinity school. And in divinity school, he got really involved in this notion of reconciliation that has biblical roots, but it's also a psychological issue as well. Lee started thinking about, how can I apply this to the civil litigation world? And he's done it a few times, but he got involved in this case. And the school ultimately got involved in this process. And then finally, after fighting with us, the Jesuit order got involved in this process. And what it is a reconciliation process that Lee has developed that begins in the notion that if you have hurt someone, that there are steps you have to go through to reconcile with them. And the first is, you have to acknowledge you did something wrong. You have to offer an apology. You have to be willing to do certain things from a non-monetary standpoint, because that is often what the person you have wronged really, really wants. And you have to, at the end of the day, you have to make a monetary payment, not because that solves anything, but because it's almost an act of contrition. It's a way of showing that you really internalized the mistake you made and are acknowledging it. And so Lee met with all of our clients, spent a day with each of them, asked them, what are the non-monetary things? I want to hear about what you need as a person. And our clients each gave Lee a list of all the things that they needed to hear, needed to have happen. And we got these list of things together, and we went to the defendants and we said, all right, y'all have to do all these things. We'll just continue the lawsuit. And they agreed to all these non-monetary terms. And then after that, we said, okay, well, here are our monetary demands. And they ultimately acceded to those as well. This is all being done in the face of the fact that the statute of limitations was going to kill our case eventually. But to the credit of these defendants, they were willing to go through this process. And so we, things like getting the name of the priest taken off the school, things like having certain policies changed, having special masses for victims of special abuse, establishing a process in which other victims can come forward and not have to go through the litigation process. You know, these are all things our clients wanted to see have happen. And they were things that we were able to compel the school and the Jesuit order and the Catholic Church to do. And it really took sort of the intellectual weight of Lee Taft to explain this to the defendants as to why, as a moral matter, they should be doing this. And once they bought off on that notion, And once we got all of the things that we wanted to have accomplished, I think for these men, they felt something that they wouldn't have felt just in the course of lawsuit if we would have won and got some money for them at trial. They have, to a large extent, reconciled with their faith. These are men who had for decades been angry at God, been angry at the Catholic Church, but they had this thing happen internally with them that has allowed them to reconcile. They all have reconciled with the school that they loved. They're all seem to be supporters of the school now. I think the school community itself has healed as well. And so it's just a truly wonderful story. It's a story that we don't often tell in lawsuits where we just talk about who won the verdict and how much they got. And as a trial lawyer, to me, it was far more rewarding than a verdict. Verdicts are great, but it's just money. And sometimes our clients need more than that.
That's fantastic.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com. Yeah, that's an amazing story. And there's a lot of lessons I think we can take away from that. We could devote a whole episode to just talking more about that case. I have a lot of questions, but I want to make sure we do justice to all the other great things you and Charla have been up to and your accomplishments. I think you and Charla talk about some of these verdicts, but just before the pandemic, you guys were kind of on fire trying a whole bunch of significant cases and getting great verdicts. I know I heard, I think Charla talked about the Greyhound bus case, which I remember because there were some facts that would just seem so difficult, possibly difficult to overcome, that you did overcome and got that amazing result. But do you want to talk about a few of those cases and tell the listeners about them?
Hey, I'm here for whatever y'all want to discuss. So I'd be happy to talk about them. We right before the pandemic hit in 2019, we went to trial on four different cases, and those cases were all different kinds of cases. The first one was a dram shop case, involved some Dallas Cowboy football players who went to a bar and were overserved, and on the way home, there was a tragic collision, and one of the guys died. The second one we tried was a products liability case against Honda involving a defective seatbelt. And a poor 24-year-old young girl who is a just champion, she is such a positive force. She now is a quadriplegic, but you wouldn't know it if you talked to her because she would never acknowledge that she was. She's going to overcome everything. But we tried that case for several weeks and then turned around and tried a sexual assault case for about a week, got a favorable result there as well. And then shortly thereafter, we tried the case against Greyhound. And the results were favorable in all the cases. The dram shop was a $25 million case. The Honda case was 37.6. The sexual assault case was a $32 million verdict. And the Greyhound case was a $20 million verdict. And people have asked us to talk about it. We've given some speeches. I've given some here locally in Texas and in other places. Charles spoke on it as well. I think the belief is there must be some sort of method or thing that we're using or doing that, you know, we were able to implement in this short succession of cases. And I don't think that's really the case. Each one of those cases is different. Our approach in each of the cases was a little different. Each case had their own difficulties, as all our cases do. That's why we end up in trial. If the case didn't have any difficulties, we would have probably settled it early on. So I think each of the cases, there are things that can be taken away from them. In the dram shop case involving the Dallas Cowboys, one thing that we were able to do was to get more liability placed on the bar than on the drunk driver. And that's an often a difficult thing in a dram shop case because the natural inclination is blame the guy who was driving the car who was intoxicated. Well, in this instance, the guy who was driving the car had a drinking problem. And so we embraced him as someone who we think shouldn't really be faulted as much because he's the one with the problem. And in Texas, when you get a license to serve alcohol, you take upon a duty to ensure that people drink it responsibly. And so if you have a poor guy who is not responsible, it's up to the bartender to be the one who makes sure that it's being done in a responsible manner. And I think the way that we handled the case, the sequencing of how we presented the case, I think it really helped us put most of the focus on the bar, and we actually had most of the responsibility in the bar, which is very strange in a dram shop case. Usually it's the other way around. It's usually like 80% on the driver and 20% on the bar. But the lesson that we took away from that case was, one, you can demonize the bad actor, and sometimes that's a good idea. Sometimes you might want to say, hey, if we have a very disagreeable and unlikable driver, demonize them. That'll drive up the damages. So 20% of a big number is still a big number, right? Or you can do, in this case, we had a sympathetic guy. If you embraced him and hugged him, and we had him on the stand, and we had him, you know, acknowledging that he made mistakes, and we really embraced him, it really helped us on the comparative apportionment. On the Honda case, there were several things we learned, one of which is John Campbell's a master. I know you all have had John on here before. John focus grouped those cases for us, did his big data thing. And John nailed both the damages at $37.5 million. But more importantly, John nailed the comparative apportionment. We had a case where a guy ran a red light, he was T-boned, and car rolled over. And John ran his studies, and he said, hey, if you ask for this much money, here's how much money you're going to get. And guess what? It's going to affect the apportionment of damages just based on how much money you ask for. And John nailed it that we would get roughly 67% on Honda. And so we were extremely impressed at John's ability to nail that. The thing we did in the Honda case that I think was really unique and something that I think is something lawyers should always do, which is try to think outside the box. How do you help a jury understand this question of a defective seatbelt? You know, you can do video recreations. You can bring in the chopped up car, which we did, and they can see it for themselves. But in this case, we had an issue with not so much that the seatbelt was put on correctly and it was defective, but it wasn't put on correctly. The case involved a Honda minivan in which the seatbelt was up in the ceiling in the third row, and you had to pull it down and you had to click it once to anchor it on one side of your hip and then pull it again. Our client put it on incorrectly. She reached up and did what everyone knows to do with a seatbelt: reach up, grab it, pull it across, and click it. She didn't do that other anchor. And so Honda was defending itself largely on saying, hey, look, these people didn't use it correctly. Why are you blaming us? And so we really had to deal with that. And the way that we dealt with it is we hired a bunch of people. We got video cameras and we set them up, and we just put two people in the back row of a Honda on the sides and asked the person we were surveying, we said, hey, will you go sit down? And they went and sit down. We asked them to buckle up and we watched what they did. And we did that for about 80 people, and something like 92% of them did it the wrong way. And so we showed those in trial, showed some of the people who were looking around and they can't find the seatbelt, and they finally find it back here. And then they do what everyone is trained to do, is they just reach across and click it. And I think once we showed the fact that the vast majority of people will do it wrong, it really helped us on the comparative apportionment, and it really helped us prove the defect itself. And so that sort of thing where you get people to...
Can I just ask you, what was the defect beyond the difficulty understanding how to use it? Was there was another defect, I'm assuming, too?
No, the defect was they did not do any testing to ensure that the thing would be reliably used. And so it was defective because people effectively don't know how to use it. That was the defect. The safer alternative design, which you have to show in a product's case, is to have what's called an all belts to seat system, where the seatbelt is like right over your shoulder in the seat, and you just pull it down and click it. That works with our expectancy. As people, we've been trained our whole lives, the way you put on a seatbelt is you reach up here, you pull it down and click it. Putting it up in the ceiling and requiring us to do two steps changes how people expect a seatbelt to operate. And they're free to do that if they want to change that, but they need to make sure that people are going to reliably use it correctly. And if you don't do that, then they're negligent in the design of that seatbelt. And so I think that type of study was, it was outside the box. It was something that was extraordinarily effective. And that's something we're always looking to try to do, is try to do things that are kind of outside the box. On the sexual assault case, that was a tricky case because it was right at the height of the Me Too movement. And we were trying it in a very conservative venue in Texas. I don't know if y'all ever have cases in Texas, but if you ever do, and they're in Denton County, I recommend not filing them in Denton County. It can be a very hard venue for plaintiffs. And when
we're just going to send them to you, Brian. Don't worry.
No, thank you. I'll pass. But in the height of the Me Too movement, it makes it even harder when you're talking about a sexual assault case, which is a he said, she said case. And you had a lot of these people who I think are very conservative and very disturbed by the Me Too movement. So we had a lot of things going against us. And Vore Dyer, the defense counsel, idiotically asked a question. And I think a lot of times our verdicts are more of a function of something stupid the defendant will do than anything smart we do. Defense counsel asked the veneer panel if anyone believed that boys will be boys. This is a case involving a young girl who was at a high school party who was served drinks and we think probably some sort of drugs, and she lost consciousness and two boys sexually assaulted her. And so in Vore Dyer, the defense counsel asked the panel if people thought boys will be boys. And juror number 8 raised her hand and said, you know, boys who will be boys will grow up to be men who rape women. And I think after that, we looked around and all those people we thought were going to be horrible jurors for us started nodding their heads. And we thought, okay, so maybe this Me Too movement backlash isn't going to be bad for us. We were able to try that case and we got a $32 million verdict for this young lady. But the thing that was truly remarkable is when this girl came to us, she was near suicidal. She'd been raped. She'd been embarrassed. She thought she was bad, destroyed goods. She didn't have any self-worth, any dignity. And that's how we sort of frame the closing. When I use that concept in closing is what is the value? What is the dignity of this young lady's life worth? And afterwards, I'll never forget this. Afterwards, the jury actually asked our client to go back in the jury room after they announced a verdict. It was a very odd thing. And when she walked back there, they all gave her a standing ovation. And they said how much they admired her for coming forward and having the bravery to bring this case. I think that mattered far more than anything else to this young girl. She's doing much better now. I think having that sort of acknowledgement from people that she didn't know, that they believed her and that she had worth and had dignity, I think was truly special. That same dignity issue came up in our next case, which was a Greyhound case, in which a young man who had a problem with drugs, he was a heroin addict, and he was getting on a bus from Washington to go to California. He was hoping to get cleaned up, but along the way, he had to use some heroin because he was an addict and he needed to do it. And the bus stopped at a bus stop, and he went inside a gas station, and the bus was going to leave at a designated time, and it started leaving. And he tried to chase the bus because he's being left in the middle of nowhere. He was banging on the bus, and the bus turned, and the wheel caught his leg, pulled him under, and crushed him. And the defense wanted to argue that it was our client's fault because he was a heroin addict, and he was taking heroin, and they believed he was in the bathroom of the gas station taking heroin at the time. And so it was his fault for chasing a bus into the street. And we looked at it and said, this is not an addict. This is the fact that he had an issue with drugs did not define this young man. He was a man who had a whole life ahead of him and he wanted to get better. He wanted to change his life and that was robbed from him. And so to sit there and use his problem against him, we took great offense in front of the jury about that. And I think it ultimately backfired for the defendants. They saw this young man as someone who had worth and had dignity and his life had meaning, even though he had a long, long problem with drugs. And I think throughout all of our cases, when you're really passionate about who you represent, focusing on the dignity of your clients, I think, is a very, very important and powerful thing with jurors. Certainly is borne out for us when you really have the jury recognize that they're not just deciding the issue before them. They're really kind of valuing the dignity of these people's lives. I think this is a very powerful thing. Sorry for rambling. I'm trying to cover the four cases.
That is amazing that all of that happened over such a short period of time. And you're 100% right. Such different cases and such different approaches. And being so nimble like that is admirable. So well done to you and Charla.
Yeah, I was actually taking down notes because some of those themes are useful for cases I've got coming up. And my partner's trying a sexual assault case in October. And you really communicated those cases powerfully. And I can see why you got the results you did. It's really well thought out.
Yeah, we certainly don't claim all the credit ourselves. We have people that helped us immensely with all these things. On the Greyhound case, we were trying to struggle with how are we going to deal with the fact our client was chasing this bus in the street. And Charla put a call out, and we got on the phone with the great Mark Mandel, who I know has been on this. And I just love Mark Mandel. I value his insight beyond rubies. He's just a fascinating, brilliant man. And Mark raised the issue that if you can help the jury view this, if you can frame it, in Mark's words, if you can frame this case about inevitability, that really helps out against the comparative apportionment piece. And so that's, in closing, I think my first thing I talked about was inevitability.
What do you mean by that?
When you have policies, safety policies, the reason why they have certain policies, in this case, the bus is supposed to have a policy that they check before they leave every station whether everyone's on the bus and verify it. They have policies about how they're supposed to begin operating the bus. And we got them to admit that they are aware that people will chase buses if they're left behind. And that's one of the reasons why they have to do checks. And if you don't do that, it becomes inevitable that someone is going to die. Someone's going to chase the bus. It's inevitable that someone's going to chase a bus. It's inevitable that someone's going to get run over. And by the failure to follow their safety own policies, this tragedy became inevitable. If it becomes inevitable, then it could be our client who's a heroin addict, it could be a grandmother, it could be anyone, it could be the jury themselves. And so it's playing to that whole notion. By framing it as an inevitability, it really helps takes the emphasis off the client, and it really took out the steam out of how the defense was intending to take the case. And so we make good use of all the brilliant lawyers out there who we can talk to about, who will give us some of their time, because there's so many people who have great ideas. And we try to incorporate those thoughts. At the end of the day, we have to do it the way that feels most natural to us, but we certainly take all the advice and counsel we can get. I will say this. I think that is one of the best things about being a trial lawyer. When you're a defense lawyer, this type of thing doesn't happen. You know, defense lawyers compete for business. Defense lawyers want to be the best, way better than all their peers, because they want the client. They don't want their peers getting the client. So they don't share information in this way. And it's really sort of one of the great things about being a trial lawyer, that we have other trial lawyers and we all want each other to succeed. And we're willing to give time and advice and counsel to other lawyers. And it's just one of the things I value so much about what we do.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, that's really at base why we're doing this right now. And also, I tend to find that I really like people who do this for a living, because you're forced to put yourself out there and be real and take risks. It's not a highly corporatized environment where everything's certain and taken care of for you. And it just tends to attract a certain type of person. And I know I particularly like and gravitate towards, and I've really enjoyed getting to know you, Brent. And I learned a lot from you today. So thank you for coming on and sharing this with us.
Absolutely. My pleasure to be here. I think what y'all are doing is a wonderful thing. I've really enjoyed getting to know both of y'all over the last couple of years. I have immense respect for both of you. Raul, I don't know if you know this. We missed you in LA when we were in LA. I think you were traveling out of town, but we had a sort of impromptu case strategy meeting on the Uvalde shooting case that we're working on with Josh Koskoff and Michael Watts. And Ben came and sat down with us, and he was sort of like our focus group slash civil rights expert who was giving us some good insight on some of these claims. And so again, you know, having people who are willing to sit down and offer their insight is just an invaluable thing. But we missed you in LA, Raul. I wish you could have been there.
I wish I could have been there too. I was sad to miss it. I saw all the pictures and all of the events, and it just looked like such a fantastic time. So hopefully I get to come to the next one.
And Josh Koskoff is actually in trial today.
Yes.
We're recording this on September 14, but he's in trial today against the Alex Jones in Connecticut.
Yes, Josh is there, and he got sanctions again this morning against Alex Jones. I saw right before we started this, the judge was frustrated with the fact that Alex Jones was disparaging the plaintiff's lawyer so much, and so the judge sanctioned him. So yeah, I'm following Josh's work. I have such immense respect for everything Josh has been doing. He's a wonderful guy and a great lawyer. And so fingers crossed that turns out positive for him.
Yeah, good luck on the Uvalde shooting case. Obviously, not just us, but the whole country is pulling for you there.
Well, you know, it's one of those things that it's sort of a cause case in the sense that we're up against a whole lot of law that's really bad. There's law designed to stop this exact type of lawsuit. But I think that we can all see that the political will is not there to make a meaningful change in this area. And so as trial lawyers, it gives us the opportunity to try to hopefully affect some degree of change in a way that our political systems are just incapable of managing. It's clearly something has to happen. And if it's shutting down every manufacturer of AR-15 one at a time, then that's maybe what we have to do, because I just don't see the political will to make a fix for this type of issue.
Yeah, agreed. Well, Brent, thanks so much for doing this. I mean, we'd love to have you on again, because there's so much we didn't get to that I'd like to talk about. And maybe you can convince Charla to step down and come hang out with us lowly types on my podcast and talk to us too.
Absolutely. She will do it in a heartbeat. I just got to find time when we can get her on here, but we'll get her there. If you do it in the afternoon sometime, you might have a better chance of catching her.
Okay. Well, we're going to follow up on it.
I think right now this is usually her hour where she's in her gym, working out. She works out at a gym that's, it's over in South Dallas, and she's the only white lady in the gym, and she's just running around, just having a good old time working out with her trainer. So I think that's what she does this hour.
Okay. Well, we'll book her for the afternoon.
Yeah.
We can accommodate that.
All right, guys. It's good to see y'all.
Great seeing you, Brent. And look forward to seeing you in person soon.
All righty. Bye-bye.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.